Welcome to Plant Stories,
the modern, the old, and the crazy in between.
Fun fact, during Prohibition, California grape owners kept themselves in business by selling fruit bricks, which were dehydrated and compressed grapes that had wine-making yeast packed with them. Very clever. The packages said, "Do not dissolve fruit brick in warm water and add yeast packet, as this would result in fermentation and create alcohol, which is illegal." Oops.
Yep, I would do that.
And that will bring us into today's episode, our season finale, wine.
Hey guys, so buckle up because this wine episode is going to take a little while. There's a lot to know about wine. It's got a long, long history with us lovely humans. And even just grapes themselves have a pretty long, long history. And we're gonna talk about that today. I'm not going to go too into detail about specific types of grapes because that would make this episode even longer than it's already going to be. But I think getting a general history is still going to be, you know, an enjoyable process for everyone. So just some basic facts to start off. The fruits, known as grapes, come from the genus Vitis and the family Vitaceae, which contains about 60 to 80 species of vining plants. So kind of like typical grapevines that you think of. They're all a little bit different, but kind of similar as well.
Are these all grapes that would make wine?
No.
Oh.
And we'll get to that in a little bit. But these plants are native to the north temperate zone. So that includes areas like North America, Asia, and Europe. The plants produce kind of this like woody vine that shoots out tendrils. So tendrils are kind of like modified branches, but if you've ever seen this kind of woody vine, tendrils kind of tend to be like almost like round corkscrewy type things that grow from the woody vine of the plant. And they use these primarily to climb other objects. And for this plant in particular, can reach distances of up to 56 feet or about 17 meters or more, which is a lot. I think that's a lot.
Oh, yeah.
The leaves, which are also considered edible and are sometimes used in certain dishes and things like that.
Oh, yeah. Stuffed grape leaves.
Yeah. They're kind of like large and tooth-edged, and the flowers are small and greenish. And they usually precede the fruit, which are actual berries and range in color from green to red. So kind of however you think of basic grapes, you know, that's what we're working with here. Typically, the grapes that we ferment are the ones that have the most glucose in them. And that's partially just because, you know, it has the most sugar for the breakdowns that occur during fermentation. However, all varieties of grape can technically make a wine-like beverage when crushed and fermented. It's just probably not what you're buying at the store. So the grape that is most used for winemaking is the European wine grape, which is called Vitis vinifera. And it's the most, you know, it's the standard. Most types of wine are made with a variety of this grape. So you kind of have like the overarching species, and then there's all these different, you know, smaller types of grapes with all these like little tiny differences that make a big difference when it comes to the actual wine. There are at least 5,000 different varieties of wine grape.
Nice. And,
yeah, there's a lot. And all of them have kind of like a myriad of qualifying factors for identification. And so that includes things like size, color, shape of berry, juice composition, ripening time, and disease resistance. And in addition to the variety of grape used, there are sometimes like small, you know, little differences within the process itself that can result in different flavors and kind of that wide variety that we have today. In addition to the European wine grapes, there are also plenty of different kinds of grapes. So such things like table grapes, which are the ones that you would probably just like get at the grocery store and eat. Or the grapes that are used for raisins, which are different than the ones from the grocery store and different than the ones used for wine. So there are a lot of types of grapes, and you know, they're also popularly produced. Like table grapes are pretty popular as well. And I think something that is also important to remember, because we're about to really dive into the history of wine, is that wine, much like beer, was one of those common drinks that people drank instead of water, because a lot of people didn't have access to fresh, you know, safe water. And mm-hmm. much like the process of making beer, the process of making wine made the beverage actually safe to drink. So when we're talking about the history of grapes and subsequently of wine, one thing that's really important to note is that grapes have actually been around for probably millions of years and have probably really only been cultivated for human use within, you know, somewhere like between 6 and 8,000 years.
So dinosaurs were eating grapes?
Possibly. We don't know, but possibly. There's evidence of fossilized grape leaves and stems that date back as far as the Neogene and Paleogene time period. So that's at least like 2.5 million years ago, and possibly as far back as 65 million years ago.
Very cool.
In the Northern Hemisphere. Yeah. And that's pretty crazy. So clearly it was around for a long time before humans even thought about harvesting it.
Something that nature got right real quick.
Well, it's interesting, though, because these grapes, they're not the same as the ones that we eat today. And we'll talk a little bit about that in a minute. But because it's been around for so long, its existence, all things considered, is really pretty unlikely, because that means that grapes had to survive the Ice Age, which, you know, was a feat for a plant that can now be, we know, to be kind of finicky about things like humidity and temperature. And mm-hmm. it's possible that there was actually a much wider variety of grapes that we don't know about that, you know, were killed off during that time. It's also important to note that the first grapes after the Ice Age, or that the ones that managed to survive the Ice Age, were dioecious, which means that they have male and female plants, and were completely dependent on insects to transport their pollen. So the fact that they survived that is kind of just like an incredible stroke of luck. If you think about it, you know, plants that did somehow manage to survive this Ice Age period were probably isolated and kind of far from each other, and, you know, would have had to have insects carry their pollen, and that would have meant that they would not have, you know, reproduced at like a rapid rate. So the fact that they survived is pretty crazy. You know, if a female plant was too far away from a male plant, it just wasn't happening. So somehow they did manage to survive. But even during that time, you know, fruit from the coupling of these plants was very unpredictable. So we think of grapes as these like big, juicy berries that are tasty and sweet, but it's pretty likely that original grapes were small and bitter and full of gross seeds. So we had these really, you know, gross
bitter berries.
Yeah, that we probably didn't love so much. But then eventually there was a mutation that occurred that actually changed grapes into self-pollinating plants. You know, in plants, typically the female anatomy is present in the plant because there's a gene that suppresses the growth of the male anatomy. But a mutation caused a plant with both male and female genes to be born on the same plant, which resulted in a vine with much more abundant fruit and something much closer to the grapes that we know and love so much today. Eventually, these vines were then the ones selected by humans to be grown in their settlements, probably because they did self-pollinate. They were easy to graft and move in order to grow. And, you know, so they would take the yummiest of these fruits and they would take cuttings of those plants to create basically genetic clones, even though they didn't really probably think of them as genetic clones, but they were. And it's also kind of, you know, around the same time that pottery began to exist. And so that's probably really how wine first began. You know, you have this pottery and you decide to store your grapes in it. And maybe you crush those grapes so you can fit more grapes in the container. But originally, the grapes wouldn't necessarily ferment just on their own in the container. As we know, you need, you know, yeast basically to do that. Or in some cases also fungus. And so originally, you know, a lot of plants have yeast on them, but it's actually oak yeast that eventually fermented grapes. And so it's believed that either the vines themselves were growing up onto oak trees, and that is how oak yeast was introduced. And so then when you crushed those grapes, the yeast that was on the grapes from the oak would then ferment it. Or it's possible that they took actual, you know, like acorns or something like that and put them in with the grapes, and that's what caused the fermentation. But somehow, in some mysterious way, the yeast species Saccharomyces cerevisiae, I'm sure I'm saying that horribly wrong because I'm the worst, but oak
yeast. It was
yeast,
so confident.
I know. But oak yeast made its way into these kind of like crushed grape concoctions, and that caused the fermentation that first started to produce wine. And that yeast now is actually fully domesticated and often used to create beer or wine, and sometimes specialized strains even used in bread. So when we're talking about its history more directly related to humans, you know, the oldest winery that's been discovered is in Armenia, and it's thought to have been around from like 4100 BC or so, and it was discovered in 2007 by researchers from UCLA. So it's a relatively recent discovery, but that shows you that like wine itself has been around for a really long time. It's definitely been present in kind of the human consciousness for quite a while. And on top of that, there's evidence from some other researchers, such as Patrick McGovern, who analyzed ancient pottery fragments and found there to be evidence of grape fermented beverages dating back as far as like 7000 BC, including in places like China. So the Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans were also very sophisticated winemakers. So as far as we can tell, based off of current research, the only cultures in the Northern Hemisphere to not make a wine-like beverage from native grapes was the Native Americans. And we'll talk a little bit more about why that might be later. It's also true that this beverage became very associated with religion, and that's kind of religion in general. So the Egyptians used wine because it kind of resembled blood, and that made it the perfect substance for rituals and ceremonies. as kind of like the blood alternative. Like, okay, we won't sacrifice you. We'll just use wine. It was also introduced to the Phoenicians, who were from the Middle East and who did cultivate and spread wine throughout other areas of the world, making wine a part of the rituals of other religious ceremonies, including, you know, they did come in contact with Jewish peoples and later on regions that would be considered Christian regions. And so they also introduced it to the Greeks, who began to kind of perfect the actual making of the beverage. And the Greeks saw it as the symbol of trade, religion, and health. And whenever a new area was conquered by the Greeks, they would actually settle there and then bring wine grapes with them. So places like Sicily and some of the south of Italy were some of their earlier colonies, and there's evidence of growing wine grapes there from that time. When the Romans came into power, they actually just kind of like took wine as their own. They're like, all right, wine is ours now. And right, and they actually even created their own quote god of wine, who was Bacchus, and included it as a very integral part of their culture. They built they built wine up in a way that they were able to use some of the cultivation methods from the Greeks, but perfect them and, you know, make it into its own process. And then they also continued to spread the influence of wine to other areas such as France, modern day Germany, modern day Italy, modern day Portugal, and modern day Spain. So that kind of just like geographical area, I'm not sure what all those places were called at that time, but you know what I'm talking about. So when the Roman Empire eventually adopted Christianity, it was also made kind of a central part of the Christian religion. And that's really how the church and monks got involved in the making of wine. We already know kind of that the making of some of these things gets taken over by the church a lot of times, because the church is responsible for like the medicinal practices as well. In this case, they were kind of in on it right from the beginning. And although many of like the early scientific advances from like the Greeks and Romans were lost during the Middle Ages, or, you know, like ignored and kind of slipped into oblivion or whatever you want to call it, this particular thing, winemaking, they kept. They were like, oh no, we need this. We're going to keep needing to make wine. That's going to be a thing. So by the 1500s, winemaking was starting to transition to more private enterprises. And because of this, it was brought to new territories as the Europeans expanded trade. So this included bringing wine to places like the Americas, North America, South America, places like Japan. And although local grapes were found in places like Florida, the wine they made was considered unpleasant, and the Europeans often gave up and imported European wine instead. And so it's very likely that if Native American people had tried to make wine, it wouldn't taste good. And they had a bunch of their own stuff, you know. There are plenty of things that they were making, you know, beverages with on their own. So they probably didn't need wine, but the Europeans still tried. It's arguably actually champagne, which clearly we talked about earlier around New Year's, that put French wines on the map for the rest of the culture, since wine clearly wasn't invented in France, but champagne was. But it is also true that France was one of the places where they devoted the most land to winemaking. And they used it often as a product for trade.
And for all their festivals.
Correct, yeah. So, you know, it was important still, but it wasn't necessarily wine itself that put France on the map, even though when we think of wine, I feel like the first thing we think of is the French. Wine was incredibly popular for quite a while until a teeny tiny pest challenged the entire industry. And we'll talk about that in a minute, but it took a while to come back. And when it did, a new variety of vines emerged. And that's mostly what we drink today. So there was a time period where there was a bunch of devastation for the wine producing grape plants. And we did talk about that a little bit when we talked about absinthe, because it is kind of what spurred the popularity of absinthe. But that happened. And when the drink was originally brought over to the American colonies, it was often used as a celebratory drink, but was not often thought of as much as other beverages, such as like beer or whiskey. And since they couldn't make it here, you know, it didn't become the primary thing here. But in plenty of other places, you could make it. And now we make it in California, so... Also some challenges, though, that were brought forth by wine and the wine industry. And so naturally, since Americans ruin everything, oops, you know how it is. They were quite frustrated when they brought European wine grapes here and they would just wither and die. They kept planting them. They kept dying. Kept trying. Nothing changed. Several experiments, even by prominent people of the time who had the money to keep buying importing the European grape plants and like seeing if a different variety would work, such as like Thomas Jefferson, were very unsuccessful in trying to make this wine. And the reason turned out to be because of this tiny aphid called Phloxera, that's what we're going to call it. Phloxera. And it is this very tiny bug with an extremely strange and ruthless life cycle that went kind of like unnoticed for a long time. Like clearly the crop was being decimated. You know, these plants were being killed, but they didn't understand why these plants were dying. And these bugs are pretty small. So it might not have been immediately noticeable as to exactly what was causing the problem. And I mean, anybody who's actually spent any time with plants knows that it's like not 100% unusual to find a bug on a plant.
Right.
Whether or not that bug is harmful to the plant or not, you know, but as I'm sure in this time too, it was pretty difficult to discern. Basically, this bug... it reproduces for like a couple generations without any males. Like somehow these females just like reproduce more females. And then something happens where they actually need to reproduce with males. And so a bunch of males are born, but then they just literally exist to like mate and then die. So like they don't even have a digestive tract. They're literally only born to be mated with and then die.
So, wow. Very efficient.
Yeah. And so that was strange. You know, like it's not like you could interrupt their mating cycle because they didn't mate really for a while. Or even if you did, they would just like make babies out of nothing again.
Yep. It's like a 1 hour window or something.
Right. And then their habitats even actually change during their life cycle. So like at one point they spend their time on the leaves and they build these little like, they're kind of like, I'm sure it looked like a disease, but they're kind of like make these little domes on the plant that they live in, and then they actually go underneath the soil and attack the roots. So like, even if you were like, oh great, they're not on the leaves anymore, no, they're on the roots. And while American varieties might not have been suitable for winemaking, they were resistant to the Phloxera, and the European varieties were not, which is why the European varieties kept dying when they were brought here. Unfortunately, they didn't know why they were dying here, so they went ahead and sent some American grape plants to France. And they were infested with these little aphids, and those aphids just took out the French winemaking industry. Just decimating vineyards wherever it went. And it took years for them to understand what was going on. So
there's so many stories of things crossing the pond that are just like, why do you keep doing that? Every time you do, you like decimate something.
Right? It's like, whose bright idea was it that like, we'll share plants? I mean, I guess I can kind of understand for like certain researchers it sort of made sense, but like in this case, the Americans literally sent the plants to France as a gift. Why would you think sending plants was a good gift?
Well, they didn't have issues when they were doing it across, you know, Europe and Asia, but pff, man.
Yeah, not a good idea. And so it took them a really long time to even figure out that it was an aphid that was killing them, let alone then to understand how to deal with them to, you know, to kill the aphids. So the eventual solution ended up being that they actually grafted together American and European wine grape varieties, which is basically most of what we drink today. However, there are wine connoisseurs who go looking for the pre-Phloxera wines, which managed to survive the outbreak, because there were some small pockets of vineyards that were able to make it by. And there's also places like South America where when they brought those original wine grapes during their, you know, conquests or whatever you want to call it, they were never affected by the Phloxera, and so they are descendants of those original plants. So I guess maybe that was a good idea. I don't know. But that was a pretty big deal, and it took a long time for the industry to come back after that. There's also another challenge of growing grapes that a lot of these vineyards face, which is this fungus called Botrytis cinerea. Yes, me struggling to say scientific words again. And it causes this very gross disease that's known as Botrytis bunch rot.
Sounds gross.
Yeah, it's this rot that makes the leaves and flowers fall off the plant and then causes the rotten grapes to fill with fungus. And then when these fungus-filled grapes drop off the plant, they basically just wait there to kill another plant. The fruit also gets these like gross brown lesions on them, and that's how you know that it's been affected. And I don't know if you've ever had to deal with the fungus, maybe, you know, but it spreads quickly.
Yeah.
And it's really hard to deal with it. And this typically happens early in the season and then just destroys the entire crop. However, they have found that under the right combination of events, you can get what they call noble rot. And this rot has very specific requirements. So the rot has to begin to occur late in the season. Temperatures must stay between 68 and 78 degrees Fahrenheit, which is about 20 to 25 degrees Celsius. The air has to be very high in humidity, and the grapes have to be in the perfect ripeness. But if the stars align and all of those things occur at once, The fungus actually dehydrates the grape, but doesn't destroy it, concentrating its sugars and producing later on a wine with a distinctively slightly spicy honey or raisin flavor. And so this beautiful, you know, combination of events that leads to something positive out of something that could have been very negative is used to create what's known as botryized wines. And there are some from France, Germany, Italy, Hungary, and some other wine-growing regions. But it's very difficult to make, right? And make, you know, so that all those conditions happen. There's always a chance that they won't happen. And so these wines are often very expensive. And the process is dangerous and very unpredictable to the crop. And very few wine makers are willing to take the risk to let it anywhere near their vines, at risk of, you know, basically destroying their whole product. When we talk about today's wines, you know, we've already talked about brandy, and we've stepped a little bit into, like, vermouth. But it's also worth noting that there is kind of, like, a world of aromatized wines out there. And aromatized wines are wines that are flavored with things like fruits, florals, and spices. So, you know, vermouth is probably the most popular of those, and it is flavored with wormwood. But there are also plenty of others, some of those including mistel, which is a mixture of unfermented or partially fermented grape juice and alcohol that's used as a base and then has spices and other things added in. And then there's quinquina, which is a fortified wine with quinine flavors, such as like citrus or fruit liqueur. And so, you know, those are something to consider as well if you're looking at wines and you want to try something different or new, like regular wine just isn't enough for you. I don't know. I don't know how exciting your life is. And though the French wine industry has, in fact, recovered at this point, and, you know, French wines are very popular, Americans have still spent a lot of time trying to find a way to make good wine from American grapes. So European wine grapes were brought to California and have been used there to make wine. But a lot of American grape varieties are considered relatively hardy and grow in kind of climate zones that would, you know, be able to put use to lands that we might not be using for something else right now. And so they have been trying to find a way to make good wine from American grapes or breed American grapes with other types of grapes in an attempt to create a new type of wine grape that will hopefully survive these different climates and different, you know, levels of humidity and things. And they've sort of succeeded. So I think what's important to remember is that when we talk about French wine and we talk about this history, people in France have had hundreds of years to perfect these wine grapes and these different varieties of wine in order to make something, you know, that has a specific taste, that is consistently that taste, and that has many, you know, grapes of that variety enough to produce a large amount and then distribute throughout the world. And so Americans are behind on that. You know, it's been about 300 years of experimentations, but there are some American grape wines available. However, they're certainly not as well-renowned as the classic French grapes. And a lot of them are, in fact, European grape and American grape hybrids. So, you know, if you're ever curious, those are also out there. I think it's also important to note that in the 1980s, wine was introduced to China. And when I say wine, I'm talking about French grape wine was really like opened up and introduced to China. And China is now actually one of the world's largest producers and growers of wine, producing about 800 million liters of wine in 2019.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a lot. And you know, although there's like a little bit of history, especially much older history, with some Chinese varieties of grapes that does exist in China, it kind of makes sense that it wasn't popularized until they were introduced to the French wine, because rice wine is so popular there. And it was so much cheaper for them to make throughout a lot of their history, and is also related to their own religions. But now it's pretty popular there. Grape wine is also a thing there. And so that's what I had to tell you today about wine. It's a lot. There's a lot to unpack there. Wine is pretty great.
You've taught me so much.
That's what I'm here for. I'm just educating the masses. But I think it's pretty interesting. I think it's very... First off, I had no idea grapes had even been around that long. Like, millions of years. I don't know. That's not the one I would have guessed. Like, I remembered ferns, and I kind of, like, expected ferns. I feel like whenever you go to, like, an exhibit that has, like, dinosaurs or something, you're like, oh, yeah, it's going to be full of ferns. But I never thought of grapes. Like, Ice Age, woolly mammoths, and grapes were not a, like, vision that I put together. You know what I mean?
They do have pretty hardy vines, at least the ones that I see today. So I feel like a vining thing makes sense, and maybe some berries. Whatever their evolution process, I'm so glad we have them. I love grapes.
I love grapes. I love wine, honestly. Like,
I love raisins.
Of all the things we've talked about, I am probably the biggest fan of wine, which is sad. Cheap wine. Give me that $5 bottle.
Personally, my favorite is Spanish wine. I feel like they don't get enough credit.
Well, you know me, when we travel, I'm like, bring on the alcohol. What's your local alcohol? Let's try it. And hopefully, maybe after this year, we'll actually get to go somewhere and try something. But who knows?
Sounds like a good plan.
Who knows? But, yeah, I think it's probably time for us to go ahead and head over to the bar. Learn some bartending tips.
Hello, friends. I'm here to offer a quick lesson in wine tasting and hopefully provide you some knowledge to help you better order your next glass or pick up a bottle. So, similar to how you might think an orchestra is made up of types of instruments, a glass of wine is made up of characteristics. And there's the main five: body, sweetness / dryness, acidity, tannin, and flavor profile. So these are the five things that you would be able to describe a wine with, and also what you would be looking for when you're tasting it yourself. So body, we're going to start with red wines. They're going to be categorized into light, medium, and full-bodied. And white wines are light, full-bodied, and aromatic. These bodies can be better understood when they're compared to different kinds of milk, like skim to whole cream. So like a full cream milk is much richer and fuller in flavor than skim milk. And the same can be said for like a full-bodied wine in comparison to a light-bodied wine. The next category is sweetness / dryness. And this refers to how much residual sugar is left in the wine. If there's a lot, you'd hear it described as very sweet. If there's hardly any, it would be very dry. The next is acidity. So acids are what give a wine its sour or tart flavor. And this would manifest as a citrus flavor. And it also causes your mouth to water. And it's a good example of this one would be a Sauvignon Blanc, which is a white wine, because it tastes sour and there are strong elements of citrus and it makes your mouth water. The next category is tannin. So tannins are unique to red wines, and they're what cause that like grippy, drying feeling on your tongue. So a high tannin wine will almost make your tongue feel numb. And an example of this would be a Cabernet Sauvignon. And the last category is flavor profile. So the flavor profile of a wine is essentially every flavor and scent that you can smell and taste in the wine. And when you're tasting and smelling wine, you should try and identify any flavors or lack thereof from each of these categories: fruit, oak, earth, and other, which is a great category.
Other.
Yeah, so other will include things like peppery. That's one that typically falls in that category. Earth is where the flavor comes in from, where the region is. And that'll come in as tasting notes of like, someone once described like fallen leaves. That was an interesting description.
I only think of Parks and Rec, where that guy turns out to be a sommelier, and he's just like, this is a beautiful wine!
This is
whatever
beautiful.
He says. Yeah, like, he just says, like, really crazy stuff very loudly.
Oh, yeah. I've been a part of a couple of wine tastings where I was very new, and I was like, how are you guys, like, how are your palates picking up so many things? You know, it kind of ties back to that orchestra example where, like, you know, there are people who can listen to a symphony and they're, like, blown away because they know how to pay attention to each type of instrument and each line, and they can really appreciate everything that's going on. Same thing with wine. Like, you have to have a lot of exposure to a lot of different kinds, and that'll build up your palate, so you'll be able to appreciate each line, each of these characteristics, and like what they bring to the table. The oak one is because a lot of wines are aged in oak barrels. And then fruit, I'm not talking about just grape, there'll be like strawberry or raspberry or plum. There's all sorts of flavors going on there, so you know, pour a glass out, swirl it around, get your nose all up in there, you know, do that open mouth breathing. I know it sounds weird, but that's how you're gonna get all those different things.
I've so, also learned that it's like very important if you're tasting alcohol and you're trying to discern the flavors, to make sure that you like roll it across all the different parts of your tongue, because like each part of your tongue can taste something different. And so like a lot of people, especially if you don't like it, like if it's too sweet or something like that, you can't actually try to appreciate its full flavor because you go to swallow it right away. And that's why they do that thing too, where they like swoosh it around in their mouth and then like spit it out, like at wine tastings. Because the idea is to coat your mouth with it and then taste all the different flavors on all the different spots of your tongue.
Yeah, fun fact if you guys didn't know, different parts of your tongue pick up different flavors.
So, you know, that's the only thing I know that is in relation to this. But it's true for like beer and stuff too. Like if you're trying to taste the different flavors of something, that's kind of how you have to do it if you're trying to pick up all those little things.
Yeah, so hopefully this will help you figure out how to figure out what you like, what you're looking for. If you're out ordering or at a liquor store and you can say, you know, these are the kind of characteristics that I like, boom, you can figure out which wine to get, because they don't conveniently have taste descriptions on them, which I feel like would be really helpful.
Yeah, there's a lot of wines that don't have taste descriptions, and I find that very annoying.
I know, I gotta like just stand there on my phone and googling things, looking up descriptions online.
You're like, what the fuck does Cabernet Sauvignon taste like?
And like each one can taste different.
Exactly.
I'll give a random shout out. One of my favorite red wines is a Malbec from Llama. That's one I buy all the time. I'm like, I bet that's Spanish.
It sounds Spanish.
Argentina. So that one's good. It's dark fruit. It's strong, toasty, oaky. Oh yeah, we should also give a shout out to one of our listeners.
Georgia from Australia.
What's up?
We hear you. We love you. Thanks for listening to our podcast. You're the best.
And this is this is our season finale.
For alcohol. And now I have to think of something else. And there's so many options, I haven't decided on one yet. So
personally, I'd be down to do spices. Just throwing that out there.
I was also thinking, like, we're going into spring. Maybe it's time for flowers or trees.
Oh, yeah.
So
I can't wait till we dive deep into all the things that trees can do and that they do for each other. Trees
are freaking amazing. Like, honestly, it's just, trees are insane. I love trees. I've always loved trees. I've always felt a personal connection to trees.
Mm-hmm.
Which is a really weird thing to say, and I caught on very early in my life that if I was like, I love trees, people were like, okay.
Whatever. I still regularly hug every large tree that I see.
There's nothing better than, like, sitting out on a nice day that's, like, not too hot, not too cold, under a tree and, like, reading a book or something. Honestly, golden. Mm-hmm. That's golden stuff.
It's got, like, that perfect nook in its trunk, just meant for you.
And it's even better when accompanied by a glass of wine. So just a thought.
Ugh, classy.
If you're looking for something to do, I recommend. But I digress. Thank you all for listening to us and surviving another season of Plant Stories with us. We're so grateful that you're here. Please feel free to tell your friends about us.
And keep a lookout on social media for us to announce what our next season's going to be about.
Yes, I will do that.
See you all next season. Bye. Bye.